Okay, as you know, those of us that have been here the last couple of days, in this class period, we dealt with a tough topic, but I appreciate the attitude with which the audience helped me deal with it. I left here yesterday thinking I have nothing more to say about this topic this week, and that's essentially true, but I did have a comment or two that have come to me that I thought were worth repeating. One of them that I thought was very important for us to remember is that when we do encounter individuals who are struggling with this or maybe even having succumbed to this issue of homosexuality, yes, we need to point out to them that that's not what the Bible teaches, but maybe we should also remember we need to convert them to Christ first and get them focused on Christ, and then the teachings will more easily and more palatably and more lovingly fall into place. And I thought that was an appropriate comment, and I wanted to share that with you. It doesn't mean we won't talk about it anymore. I know that we will. Out of this last 2 days, I've already had one congregation schedule multiple days for us to talk about it, and I'll be happy to do that, and other brethren I'm sure will, because it is an issue that is very much on our minds. Having said that, I want to go back now and at least take a few minutes to go back and try to remember one of the overriding things I was asked to do, and it was to how to teach our teens and how to pass some of our beliefs, or the Bible's beliefs, I should say, onto them. So I'm going to take a little bit of time to doing that this morning, and then we will get into absolute truth, we will get into morality, and we'll get into talking about evolution without using science. That'll lop over into tomorrow, and that will kind of wrap up the main thoughts that they wanted me to address. I have a question or two that I've been given that I'll interject here today. Most of the comments and questions I've gotten have just naturally woven their way into my presentation, so I haven't had to say, well, this is a question I got. I just have said, this is the answer as I understand it. But I want to talk a little bit about decision making here for just a moment, because in the teen years, I believe for most of us and for most of them, there is a really important transition going on. And the transition is they transition from doing what they have been told to do so that they don't get in trouble, to having now starting to think about what is right and wrong, what is ethical, what is moral. And as parents and as brothers and sisters in the Lord, that is a very important time for us to be trying to teach them, because we cannot teach our young people how to handle every situation they're going to encounter. What we have to try to do is to instill in them the principles that will allow them to then make the right decisions. My parents could not have taught me about crack cocaine, because when I was growing up, that wasn't a big deal. The Bible doesn't talk about it per se. The Bible gives us principles, for instance, with which we can apply. And that's what I think we need to do with our young people also. But as they move into the teen years, and it varies chronologically with different children or different teens, they do naturally begin to question the principles that have guided you and I. They learn as teens the ability to act on principle, or at least they will. We just want them to be the right principles. If we don't teach them, somebody else will, as I said the other day. But they do begin to question the values of others. And that's when, as parents or grandparents or just observers, the road gets a little bumpy. It's nice when you just buckle them in the back seat and say, we're going, and hush. But that doesn't work. They start getting driver's license, and they go off in their direction, and you go off in your prayerful direction for them. And they discover a whole arena of independence that it's new and it's exciting. And they begin to develop. I need to get that one down real quick, or John Woody will see a misspelled word up there. They begin to develop. Well, I just got to bite the bullet. Here it is, John. He's been waiting all week for this moment. You're waiting for the return of Christ. John's waiting for a misspelled word. And he's got one. But seriously, it's in this era, in this time frame, that they largely develop their value systems. Now, that is not to undermine the early years. It's been said, you know, give us your children for the first 5 years of their life and they're ours. There's some truth to that. But there's a lot of examples here of people whose value systems are different than the value systems they were taught in the first few years of their lives. Albert Mohler quoted a college professor, and he has a very nice article on it if you want to Google it and look it up. But he quotes this college professor as, you can have them for the first 18 years, you give them to me for the next 4 years, and they're mine. Well, that's not always true, but some of you know that that can happen. But it's a very crucial time for the installation of values. And therefore, it's a very important time for positive guidance. Positive guidance in terms of helping them develop these principles. And that's what I want to talk a little bit about in these few minutes. As adults, we often are very, very focused on rules. And we want our young people and our children to do this, this, and this. Let me give you an example of it that might shed a little bit of light on what I'm trying to say. When your children or your grand, when our young people go to school, what do you want them to do? You want them to get an A. But I'm going to propose to you that getting an A is not the most important thing for them to learn. We want them to get an A so they'll get a scholarship, but it'll save us money, for instance. And that's wonderful. But what you want to instill in them is the principle of how important an education is to their lives. Once you instill that principle, they will want to get an A. So I would not punish my kids so much for not getting an A as I would be disappointed with them for not understanding the value of an education. Because when you understand that principle, the precept of getting an A or doing the best you can falls into place. So, rules are important. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying principles are more important because those are the things that will guide the rules of their lives. So what do we want them to learn? Well, what I want them to learn are the principles that we have in the Bible. Now, the Bible teaches us in two ways, principles and precepts. And they need to learn both. A precept is a specific thing. Thou shalt not lie. We all understand that. There's no argument about what it means. Now, it doesn't mean we always do it. But that's a precept. A principle would be, do good unto all men. Well, what does that mean? Well, you've got to decide what that means in a specific situation. You might see that same concept when you're driving. You go down the highway and it says speed limit 70 miles an hour. That's an absolute principle, a precept. You're not supposed to go over 70. You might also see a sign that says drive carefully in rainy conditions. Well, what does drive carefully mean? Well, that's a judgment you have to make, but it's a warning. But it's a guiding principle. And what we want them to learn are those principles that will guide their lives. Our teens need for us to teach them their values so that they can create their own strong moral fiber. If all we do is teach them what we want them to do rather than teach them how to think through what they need to do, we will not be very successful. Now, where do our values come from? Where will their values come from? Well, in general, values, I think, come from our experiences. They come from our learning. They come from that which we are associated with. We largely, osmotically, and maybe somewhat intellectually, develop our own value systems, or we adapt value systems. I don't know that we develop them as much as we adapt them. So we need to expose them to the proper environment. This is a proper environment. Some people have said this week, well, wouldn't it be awful if we don't have a two-week or a two-weekend meeting next year? I'm rather ambivalent on that because I don't have a chapter and verse that says we have to. And I don't think we should get caught up in that, but it is a positive thing, especially for our young people. And I don't think that's wrong. I think that's a positive thing in the fellowship that they have. But how do we go about instilling biblical values in our teens? Well, I'm going to give you a list of suggestions. I feel a little bit like the gentleman who started to write a book on parenting when he was in his 20s. And his title was, How to Raise Your Children. Then they had a couple of kids, and he still hadn't finished the book. But he went back and changed the title to Suggestions for How to Raise Children. By the time he finally got the book written, he had five kids, and the title was, Has Anybody Got Any Ideas? So take this next section with that humility, okay? If my two boys were here and hearing this section, they'd say, Where do you get that? I know, and I didn't have it when they needed it. And some of these are just so basic, but let me go through about six or seven. I think you cannot overestimate the being of a good role model. We have heard this over and over, but sometimes they will not hear our words because our actions speak so loud. And you and I both know that. Children of all ages learn by imitating. You and I probably still learn by imitating. And they are very adept at picking up the differences between what we say and what we do. It goes back to the phrase that I used earlier this week that I'll repeat. Faith is often more caught than taught. And that is not to minimize the need to teach our faith. But if it's not something that they can see and mimic, it probably or may not work. If you want your children to be giving and unselfish, then you need to be giving and unselfish in a consistent manner. Next, I would say watch for teaching opportunities. Dave Behartman made a statement in his presentation on Tuesday. I think he was probably talking about his children when they were younger, but he didn't specify, that he found when they were in the car, maybe coming home from church, that was a good time for he and Vonna to talk to the kids about what they'd learned in class because they had a captive audience. Well, as they become teens, we don't necessarily have that same dynamic of captive audience, but we will spend a lot of time, maybe in the cars, with our teenage or young people. And that is still a wonderful time to have a teaching opportunity. Now, the teaching opportunity changes as they, or should change as they become teens, because it has to be less preachy and more engaging, in my estimation. But maybe you're watching the evening news and you see a story about someone who rushed into a building and saved somebody. That might be an opportunity to look at a young person in your home or that you're with and say, what do you think about that courage? Now you're having a little discussion on the value of courage or the value of unselfishness. I'm just saying, look, be sensitive to these opportunities because they are there. They are absolutely there. Number three, talk frequently with them about values. Now, I did not say preach frequently. I said talk frequently. John took us in the previous class to Deuteronomy chapter 6. And I think he was looking primarily at verse 4, if I recall. But I'm going to go there, and I want to look at verses 6 and 7. Deuteronomy chapter 6, which is commonly called the Shema, verses 6 and 7. And these words which I command you this day shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sittest in your house,
when you walkest by the way, when you liest down, and when you risest up. Talk frequently to our young people about values, about beliefs, about principles, before they really need to have to engage them maybe in some of their very important decision-making processes. Show them how to serve and be selfless. It's probably been 10 years ago, but I remember one of the members at Smart Road, we were having, I think some kind of mechanical problem. And the dad sent his son over to try to fix it. It might have been a lawnmower. I don't even remember for sure. And I felt kind of bad. Here's this teenage kid over there trying to fix my lawnmower, and he'd rather be doing something else. But I remember what his dad said to me later. He said, no, he needed to come because we're trying to teach him how to serve other people. That sounded good to me because my lawnmower wouldn't work. But I thought it was a pretty... I wouldn't remember it 10 years later if I didn't really think it was a good thing for him to say, because I don't remember yesterday very well. That man understood that he needed to teach through action, not through sermon, how this young man could serve better. Encourage them in difficult times. Life's sometimes hard. It's hard for you, it's hard for me, but it's probably really hard during puberty and the teenage years. And we see them make all kinds of mistakes, and sometimes we need to correct their mistakes, and we need to correct them, we need to discipline. That's not what I'm saying, but they oftentimes need some real encouragement. That's a way to instill values. Praise them when they uphold their values, when they do it right. Sometimes we're probably guilty of only talking about values when they abuse them rather than when they reinforce them. But it's so almost common sense that I almost hate to put this list up there, but I put it up here because we forget it. Just a couple more. Share your life experiences. Now, I made myself a note when I put that in there, is this is not one of those, when I was a young person, blah, 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 and then they mentally throw up. Just like you did when your parents said it to you. No, this is a time when you can look for an opportunity to, hey, I struggled with this when I was this age, and this is how I worked through it. And you get this dialogue. And you're sharing. Not in that, hey, I'm great and I went through tough times and you don't know what it was like and we walked 4 miles to school uphill both ways. You know, that kind of garbage. You didn't do it, first of all. And they know you didn't do it. Pay attention to who else might be teaching them. Pay attention to who else is spending time with your children. Because they are learning from them, whether it's a formal, and it probably will be a rather informal, learning experience. We had a talk on we are in the world but not of the world. I wanted my boys to be in the world in the sense I wanted them to be exposed to, don't take this wrong, I wanted them to be exposed to bad things while they still lived in our home. And we had a chance to help them work through those, rather than have them only exposed to bad things after they left our home. And I don't mean, Glenn, this is not funny. Okay. In our home, there's plenty of bad, because I'm there. In your home, there's plenty of bad, because you're there. I don't mean bad like murder and lying. We're human. Our boys went to public school. If I had to do it again, that's the way I'd do it. And that is not a knock on homeschooling. I just prefer for them to be exposed to these things while I still had a chance to help them a little bit, because now they're gone and they're men. They do whatever. It's the chance to expose them to the principles. Pay attention who they're paying time with. Donna and I moved to the country, not because I'm a country boy. I don't like country. What I like about the country is you have less neighbors. So I just kind of defeated my concept of exposing them to bad. But we wanted more, some control over who they were spending their time with. And you can have Christian families in town, okay? I think. Ask them questions that stimulate dialogue. If any of you are in sales, this is right out of Sales 101. And this is more important. But what are we trying to do? We're trying to sell them the biblical principles that we know should guide their lives. Now, I know this is not easy for some of us to go through because we've had sadness. If you have had children that have not yet or have are not now responding as you want them to, you remember one thing. You never forget to pray for them because you never know what's going to happen. And the seeds are planted, and may they, we pray, sprout. So what do I mean by questions? Well, I'm just going to give you a few examples that occurred to me. In sales, there's what's called open-ended questions and closed-ended questions. A closed-ended question is one you answer with one word. That, you don't want those. You want questions that require at least a sentence. Or if it can be answered in one word, you're ready with a follow-up. Because you don't learn much from yes and no. If you could be anybody in the world, who would you be? You know how illuminating of a discussion that can produce? You can use that with the people sitting right next to you. It causes them to think. And it tells you a lot about where their minds are and maybe where you need to guide them a little bit more. If you saw someone hit someone else's car in a parking lot and not leave a note, what would you do? That's going to tell you a lot about where their mindset is on integrity. I don't know what answer you're going to get, but you're going to get that picture of what's going on in their heads. The film's up there. It's been exposed, but it's not yet fully developed. And we want to massage maybe the image a little bit before they leave our homes. If you had $1,000, how would you spend it? You can't answer that with a yes. You can say, yes, I'd spend it, but that's not the question. It's how. That's what makes that an open-ended. You learn a lot. I don't think they would mind saying this, but it wouldn't matter if my sons were here. When we would go on vacation, I got tired of them coming every day saying, I need money. So we just gave them X amount of money at the beginning of vacation and said, that's it. And back then it was $20. Now it might be $22. But back then it was $20. And if we went on a 2-week vacation, I can almost guarantee you this, and Donald, I think will support this, one of them would have it spent before the first week was over. The other one would come back with $15 in his pocket. But we were trying to teach them. I didn't really care which way they did it. I just wanted them to learn that the principle that there's an end to the golden rainbow. We did this with them on the Nike shoe or the Air Jordans that cost, those tennis shoes cost more than my suits. They had to have them. Okay, I knew what a pair of tennis shoes cost. So let's say it was $50. Air Jordans were $120. I said, here's $50. You can either add to it or you can go buy a pair of my red dot whatevers. I didn't care. But we're teaching them principle. You've done this. If you had $1,000, how would you spend it? That's not a bad question to ask some adults, I guess, who haven't learned the principles that I hold dear. If you saw someone bullying someone at school, what would you do? These are just examples. We're driving down the highway with a young person. you ask a question like this, you can just have a wonderful visit. Not a sermon. Just a wonderful give and take of two adults in their minds. It's unbelievable what some of these discussions can mean. You can think back to discussions you've had with people, not necessarily your parents, about things like this that have really stuck with you and really formed your value system. Okay, I'm going to pause there. We'll allow 3 or 4 minutes. If anybody has a comment, and they do, Mark, just for the sake of the tape, hang on. I didn't give Tom a heads up here. Thank you, Tom.
This is a topic I'm very passionate about. And although your statements, I agree 100%. One of them I would add is, parents, quit being selfish with your time. You brought them into the world. Take care of them. It's when, well, I have to go to bed, when your child's ready to talk. Be willing to spend the time. You know, and that to me is probably the number one thing we can fail at. And, you know, I could go on about this, but asking them questions is important. Find out what they want. The other thing is don't insult your teenagers. With them dumb kids, they finally come an age where they know what a hammer and a screwdriver is. Take advantage of it. And when they're having those moments where boys are growing hair on their chest, leave them alone and then talk to them when they're civil. It just seems like, you know, when they're having those moments, we just seem to want to poke at them. Leave them alone, give them a chance to collect themselves, and then talk to them when they're civil. And you'll be amazed that that help can sure come in handy.
I think I felt a little passion there. And I don't disagree with you. If you had asked my youngest son, who's now in his 30s, what he heard me tell him more times over and over, I would simply say, think, Shane, think. In fact, he put that in a talk, and I didn't realize I'd done that, but he said, that's what Dad always said. Think. I couldn't give him all the... I could tell him what I want him to do, but that's not the important thing. I wanted them to learn what they should do. Leslie?
I just wanted to tell you that if I had $1,000, that I'd give it to the church.
Okay, thank you. And I don't think I doubt that. Okay, well, we'll take one more. Pam?
As parents, don't forget you were teenagers once.
Yeah,
remember that. That's a hard one.
I've been told that. I'm not sure I was, but... I just seem to skip from 3 to 20. But you're right. And you learn. You learn. And you don't give up. You don't give up. Okay, I had a question that I was given that didn't just naturally fit into my notes, but I thought it was needful or worthy of this. And it said, when should women not teach a Sunday morning or Wednesday p.m. teen class or college age class if the class has baptized male members in the class? And I think that's a very practical, appropriate question. And it usually stems from 1 Timothy chapter 2, where it says a woman is not to teach or usurp the authority over the man. Well, I will tell you what I believe on this, but before I do that, I think it's an area of prayerful judgment. There is no necessarily one answer fits every single situation. Number two, I think that would be an area where I would very much rely on the counsel and guidance of your eldership so that it sets the proper tone and not a disruptive tone for the congregation, because different people feel very strongly about this. Having said that, the area of judgment for me is when does a person become a man or a girl become a woman? Well, I do not believe you become a man or a woman the instant you're baptized necessarily. You could have a 10 or 11 or 12-year-old boy or girl who gets baptized and maybe understands it and it's an appropriate thing to do,
they don't instantly become a man or a woman. They're still a boy and a girl. So I don't, personally, I don't draw the line that it's always inappropriate for women to teach a class if there are baptized individuals, teens, children in it. But at some point, it becomes pretty obvious that the boys are now going into manhood and the girls are going into womanhood, but we'll go with the boys because that's the discussion. And I think it is appropriate to extract oneself from a formal teaching mode at that point. And whether that's, I can't put an age to it. Some of you guys were men when you were 15. Some of you were men when you were 18. Some of you are still working on it. And I don't mean that to be flippant. But the Bible does say, now, teaching, I use the word formal teaching because that to me is important. I still learn from women. And I hope you do too. But that's different than having, and John was talking, I think, a little bit about the authority. The president has authority more than he does, et cetera, et cetera. Just the fact that the elders asked me to stand up here and teach bestows a certain amount of authority on me. I am absolutely no smarter right now than I was an hour ago sitting by my wife. But I have more authority. And we have to respect what God's wishes are in that area. And it does become appropriate for the especially the young men to be taught by a man at some point in that stage. I just don't know how to put a year on it, so we have to just work that out as a congregation. Now, sometimes I've been in situations where there just were no men who would teach them, and that puts the women in a very difficult spot. I still don't know, necessarily think that's a time to violate what the Lord has told us to do. I might even bring them into the adult class if that's the case. But I'd be very, very disappointed in the men of the congregation if no one's willing to teach them. You know, I don't know about for girls, but for boys, there is a very significant transition when you have a male teacher. In elementary school, I still remember the exact year and the exact name of my first male teacher. Was he any better? It was sixth grade. Was he any better than my fifth grade teacher? No. But it made an impact on me for whatever reason. And I think you can all kind of relate to that. Does anybody want to make a very brief comment on that? Good. We'll move on. I'd be happy to. I don't know who gave me the question. It does come up. And I'm sure there's differing opinions on that. I do feel strongly that simply being baptized does not make you a man. It makes you a Christian. But at some point, you do become a man, and that's a prayerful judgment thing, of which then it would be inappropriate. Okay, I talked a little bit earlier, and I'm going to start moving into the concept of absolute truth. We'll just start this. We'll probably finish it tomorrow along with morality and maybe a little bit on science if we have time. Remember I said in one of my earlier slides that one of the things I think that has really hammered us is this losing of definitions or redefining terms. You know, when you and I were growing up, if you're over 30 or 40, they didn't have to teach us what marriage was, we knew. They might have to teach us that we ought to get married or that we, if we didn't get married, we shouldn't have sex. But the definitions were kind of clear. Now we've got to go back and reaffirm the definitions. And that's an extra chore. We've got to reaffirm the definition of marriage. We've got to redefine or reestablish the definition of morality. People don't even agree on what that is. People have always done immoral and moral things, but at least we kind of were working from the same list. Math. Boy, has that changed. And I've got a very brief example of that, kind of a humorous example, I think, maybe, but if not, it's still telling. But truth is being redefined. Vast majority of people in the world, the vast majority of the people in the United States do not believe there is an absolute truth. They simply don't. And their lives show it. Let me run through rather quickly this math illustration. Some of you may have seen it. 1960s arithmetic. A logger cuts and sells a truckload of lumber for $100. His cost of production is 4/5 of that. What is his profit? $20 to all of us that learnt math. The 1970s. A logger exchanges a set L of lumber for a set M of money. The cardinality of set M is 100. The set C of a production cost contains 20 fewer points. What is the cardinality of set P of profits? Someone commented they wish they had died before PowerPoint. I'm glad I got out of school before that. I don't even know if that makes sense. This one I can relate to. A logger cuts and sells a truckload of lumber for $100. His cost is $80. His profit is $20. Find and circle 20. That's when I went back to college. Today's version. An enlightened logger cuts down a beautiful stand of 100 trees in order to make $20 profit. Write an essay explaining how you feel about this as a way to make money. Topic for discussion. How do you think this made the forest birds and squirrels feel? I think in Rick's class, he made, and I'm probably in other classes too, but I know he made a point about the importance of facts versus feelings. We have become a very touchy-feely society. And if that means we are compassionate and loving, then God bless our society. But oftentimes, it means we put feelings above facts. And this is kind of just a humorous illustration of maybe how, with some exaggeration, I'm sure, that's happened in math. Feelings or truth? A 1991 survey asked, do you agree strongly, somewhat, or disagree somewhat, or strongly with the following statement? There is no such thing as absolute truth. Different people can define truth in conflicting ways and still be correct. That was the question that was asked. And again, with any survey, you can quibble at the numbers, but you cannot quibble at the trend. Only 28% of the respondents expressed a strong belief in absolute truth. 72% of the respondents in 91, and I'm sure it hasn't gone down, did not believe there was an absolute truth. More surprisingly, only 23% of evangelical Christians accepted this idea. Now that's in the broad sense of probably the Protestant world. But only 23% of people who at that time went to a Protestant organization felt that there were absolute truths. Another survey showed 70% did not believe in absolute truth, which is basically the same thing as was said. So should we be surprised that our young people struggle sometimes with absolute truth? I did not, maybe you did not, struggle with absolute truth. I struggled with doing it, but I didn't struggle with understanding that it existed. Okay? Because I was raised in the math problem number one. Okay? 1/5 of 100 is 20, so that's the profit. I was raised that way, and most of you were also. In John chapter 18, verse 36 and following, I think it is specifically in verse 38 where Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? And we often say, well, I wish I could have heard his voice tone when he said that, because I don't know if he was really looking for knowledge or being sarcastic. And I don't know for sure, but I do know in that verse it says, Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? And the very next thing in that verse is, and Pilate went away. It reads to me as if he asked the question and really wasn't interested and didn't wait for the answer. Now, would Jesus have given him the answer or a little sermonette on it? I don't know, because Jesus was as a lamb who was being led to the slaughter and he was not going to be talkative. Today, we have a couple of things that I just want to comment on to refresh your memory or to expose you to that our young people are being exposed to or have been. One is modernism, and in modernism, God gets left out. The other one is postmodernism, and in postmodernism, truth gets left out. Well, if God is truth, I guess you could say both of them are somewhat similar, but they come at it in different ways. Now, the young people may or may not respond to the terms modernism and postmodernism. I don't know. I really don't care. But I do know they respond to the precepts and the concepts. And that's what we need to be alert to as we're trying to instill the godly principles in their lives. Rather briefly, although that doesn't look briefly, modernism is a socially progressive trend of thought that a term that affirms the power of human beings to create, improve, and reshape their environment with the aid of practical experimentations, scientific knowledge, and technology. Now, let me tell you what that says. We have gone through an era, we're still in it to some extent, but we largely, when you and I were growing up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, we were a very technically worshipful society. And technology was going to save and solve our problems. And many technical things have really happened that have been wonderful. But going to the moon did not solve our problems. Heart transplants of a physical nature have not solved our problems in a spiritual realm. We are more technically advanced than man has ever been, and we are more morally bankrupt than man maybe has ever been. But modernism focuses on human thought and technology for true answers and truth. Well, what happened is it didn't work. Families kept falling apart. People kept getting hung up on addiction. All the technology in the world didn't solve that. And so there was a social disillusionment with it because people began to understand the limitations of technology. And technology is wonderful. I mean, this presentation is because of technology, or the presentation, not the content, but the presentation is because of technology. But technical advancement has not reduced our problems. It's only exchanged old ones for new ones. And this is an example. Hairspray. When my grandmother grew up, they didn't have hairspray. What does hairspray do? Well, it solves a problem of hair flying all over the place. But it creates another problem with our ozone layer and air pollution. So technology solves one problem and turns around and creates another problem, and you don't have a net benefit. So that brought us to postmodernism. People started to think, well, modernism felt there were absolute truths, but you could find those in human thought, science, and technology. It didn't work. So then came postmodernism. I'm going to skip this slide with your permission. That brought us to postmodernism. Postmodernism is the thought that modernism did not bring us the answers and truth, therefore, truth must not exist in an absolute form. If man can't come to grips with his technology of what truth is, then truth must not exist. And that's what postmodernism is. Truth, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. You know, a boy looks at a girl and he thinks she's pretty. Another boy looks at the same girl and doesn't get the same reaction. And there is some sense, at least the appreciation of beauty, is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. Well, they take that to be also true of truth. What Mark looks at and says, that's true, I might look at it and it's not true. So we end up with tremendous ramifications on all aspects of life, civilization, and religion. Because if you do not have absolute truths, you do not have the boundaries with which end to live. Rick's teaching us about 1 John. I like 1 John, but I've always been interested in 2 John and 3 John because they're a classic example of truth.
In the book of 2 John, you had apparently a group that was very loving and feeling, but was allowing truth to be maybe compromised. In 3 John, you have a group, or at least a man, who was very attuned to the truth, but wasn't loving. You've got to have both. And I think that's largely what 2 and 3 John are about. This has affected our law, it has affected our education, and it has affected our morality. We talked about homosexuality for 2 days. It's now the law of the land. Why? Because there are no absolute truths. And nobody can say that it's wrong. In education, what occurs so often is our children are being taught there are no absolute truths, so you have to develop what is true for you. Well, you can see the ramifications of that in their mindset as it comes to the church and to God's laws. And yet that is the exact cultural indoctrination of our young people. I think we intellectually understand that, but most of us weren't raised in that heavy influx of that. I was raised 2 + 2 = 4, not set L and set M and what's the cardinality. And that may be a great way to do math. I have no idea. I just know I don't understand it. So how will we combat it? Well, when I'm talking, and I had a conversation about 2 weeks ago with a young man, and his brother has taken the position that there are no absolute truths. Well, that's a classic thing that falls under the weight of its own belief. If there is no absolute truth, then the statement "there is no absolute truth" cannot be absolutely true. It's if it wasn't so serious, it would be comical. If there are no absolute truths, then the belief that there are no absolute truths cannot be absolute. So there's just no way logic gets you there. So what gets us there? What gets us there is we want there to be no absolute truths so we can do what we want to do without consequences. That's the bottom line. And hasn't that been the nature of man from the get-go? Different words, same problem. It falls under its own weight. So why is it appealing? It removes the accountability and consequences for our actions. I could go through all the impacts this has on our society, but I chose education just because we're talking about how to help our teens and how to get our thoughts across to them. The effect it has on the minds of our children, home, public, private schooling, I really don't care which you do with your children. I think I've seen all of those work. I've seen all of them not work. So it must have to do with how it's done more than maybe the exact format. So I'm not critical of whatever one of those you choose. There are dangers in all. There are benefits in all. But when it comes to modernism and postmodernisms, educators, no matter which of those forms you choose for your children, will begin to evaluate themselves as the source of knowledge or the source of truth. Or they will teach, okay, Johnny, you decide what's true for you and what isn't. And teachers sometimes find that their job is to determine truth for their students. Many believe truth is produced. This came from a high school textbook. It is up to you to decide about your own value system, to build your own ethical code, and you will have to learn what is right for yourself. That came from the Quest for Excellence, which is a high school textbook on leadership. But you can find that elsewhere. There has to be absolute truth in order for there to be freedom. And I use this example maybe at Eminence. I forget where I say things, so if you heard it twice, then okay. True freedom is not the absence of boundaries. The absence of boundaries is chaos, not freedom. And the example that it's classically used, and I used it, not original with me, is an astronaut. an astronaut, you see them up there, they're weightless, and you say, man, that'd be neat to just float around. So they bounce off this side of the spaceship and off that side, the inside, they're bouncing around. That probably would be fun. You take that same astronaut and put him outside of the spaceship, and they're very cautious to make sure a rope's tied to him, because if not, he's just going to float off into Judgment Day. Now, which one of those two is the most free? Well, one has the absence of boundaries, and the other one has some boundaries. Well, freedom requires boundaries. And as we're talking to our young people about morality, and I'll talk a little bit more about it tomorrow, when we're talking to them about various things in the Bible, God has given us boundaries, absolute truths, so that we can be free, not to nullify our freedom. Because the absence of boundaries is not freedom, it's chaos. Absolute chaos. Why does He want us to be married to only one person and stay married to them? Because the absence of that is chaos. Okay, I'll go home with Donna tonight, and then tomorrow I'll go home with, I don't even want to say any name. But you get it. And there are we see examples of people who have these, I don't know what they call them anymore. Couples would eat together for dinner, six or eight couples, and then they'd all go home with somebody different. That's chaos. Well, it's sin. It's what it is. But it's chaos. We'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, and I apologize for taking two or three minutes over. But we can very logically teach show our young people that freedom requires boundaries. That's the point. And in fact, not only does it require it, you can only have freedom if you have boundaries. And absolute truth is not a boundary. Okay, does anybody have, not a comment or a question, are there any announcements, Joseph, that, okay. I think, Brian, you've got the prayer for the lunch. So we'll pick up here and go into a few things. If you've got something specific for me to talk about, tomorrow's the last day I'll be with you, or you'll be with me, so let me know. Let's stand, and Brian, you can have our closing prayer.